Okay, we are almost in the home stretch. After next Friday, you don't have to wake up in the morning because we have no more. I think the last ASU 101 meeting is next Friday. So that's good for you, I guess. So the last topic that I thought I would talk a little bit about is AI. And basically, what I would be able to do is to provide you mostly sort of a bird's eye view of what would be involved in developing an intelligent agent. Okay. So we'll get there quickly through definitions of what AI is supposed to be doing and in what aspects of the environment make intelligent agent design harder, and then if you are writing a program for an agent, what would the architecture for that program look like? Okay. So by the end of this, you don't necessarily learn any specific technique because that you need to do intro to AI. Okay. I would probably name some things, but you would get an idea as to essentially to remove the magic from, to the extent you have heard of AI and intelligent agent design, and you did not have any idea as to what would be the difference between those and normal programs. We'll try to discuss that. Okay. So that's my schedule for today and also next class. Before I go forward, are there any questions of anything about anything we have done, anything we'll be doing, anything about careers, anything about anything? Okay. So, did anybody get this? How many of you have heard of Turing test? Okay. So Turing test, who is Turing, by the way? If you are in computer science and you don't know who is Turing, that's like, hanging around in US and not knowing who is Washington. Okay. Because Turing essentially is sort of seen as the founding, one of the founding researchers of computer science. Okay. What's interesting is when he started thinking about computers and what they can do, the first question that he had was not how big a Excel spreadsheet can a computer, which doesn't yet exist, be able to solve. Okay. Instead, what he was thinking was, can machines think? Because after all, ever since Babbage and people before them, when people were actually generating computing machines, whether they are of the mechanical variety or the electronic variety or the made-up variety. In fact, there was a particular machine called Mechanical Turk. Has anybody heard of Mechanical Turk of late? Okay. It turns out that Amazon actually, if you search for Mechanical Turk, you will get to an Amazon site where they essentially will provide tasks that humans can do for pennies. Okay. Let's say somebody has some, a bunch of essays to be graded, and they don't feel like grading them. So they'll put it up in this marketplace and the mTurk marketplace, and they'll say, for everything you grade, you get these many cents, 3 cents or 2 cents or something like that. Okay. And in fact, so the Mechanical Turk, that name comes from an earlier Hungarian, I think, invention, where this guy was going from one European king's court to another European king's court with a mechanical robot, which was able to answer every question. It would be able to, you can ask it, in whatever the Hungarian or whatever, and it'll answer the question. And then, of course, they found later on that if you open the mechanical robot, then there was a human there. And that's how it was actually being intelligent. Okay. Again, the point is, whenever we thought of a computing device, we always wondered whether, in fact, it can think like us. It can do quote-unquote intelligent things that we get to do. And then, of course, the idea of we'll get back to MTurk probably later on, but Amazon's own view of Mechanical Turk is, in fact, it's called AAI. Okay, you know, if you think of I as intelligence, AI is artificial intelligence, and MTurk is artificial intelligence. Okay, which is basically, you know, the two artificials cancel out, and it's like humans actually who are doing the work behind, you know, and there are enough jobless humans, it turns out, that why do we want to, you know, give these jobs to computers? That's basically what MTurk's point of view is. But anyway, coming back to Turing, essentially, he was asking this question, can machines think? And the biggest issue in setting yourself a problem is getting yourself a test which you can use to decide whether you have solved the problem or not. Okay, remember when people were going into Afghanistan or Iraq or something, you know, there's always this question as to when do we know that we are done with the war? Because if you haven't defined what you're supposed to achieve, then you'll never be done because, you know, the goal has, there's no question of whether or not you've reached the goal. So Turing, before he even wondered, so first of all he was wondering whether or not you can develop a machine which can think, but then he also wanted to know, suppose somebody were to develop a machine that can think, how can I tell that it actually is able to think? What is a test? Okay? Now it turns out that it's not an easy question to answer, so he came up with, in his own mind, he came up with something called Turing test. And which basically, let's see, looks like this. A Turing test, essentially, you have a human interacting with either a machine or another human, you don't know, you know, behind the screen. Okay, and you are trying to ask all sorts of, you know, you're basically trying to have normal conversation with this machine or human. Okay, and the end of your conversation, you get to decide whether the thing behind, is it a human or a machine? And if, let's say, you did this with 100 different people off the street, and 98% of them basically said, no, we believe you are talking to human, and it turns out that actually they were talking to a machine, then you can say that there is a kind of a very high, you know, with very high confidence that this machine is able to, you know, basically make other people think that it's also human. Okay, now of course, Turing was defining intelligence in terms of what people would say is intelligence. Okay, so that's basically, you know, the joke here, but we'll get back to that in a different form here. There was a kind of a capitalist guy, a reasonable, you know, who made reasonable amount of money, called Loebner, and he for a while tried to run a Turing test. Every year they would essentially run this Turing test competition. People would submit you know, programs that can basically pass Turing test, and this would be in Boston, and so they will get people off the street and get them to talk to these machines, or sometimes humans. You can, obviously you need to make sure that, you know, some are humans, some are machines, so that you don't quite know who you are talking to. At the end, you are supposed to decide whether or not you are, you know, talking to a machine or a human. And so they would do this, and basically every year, whichever program was able to, you know, make most number of people think that it was actually a human would win the competition. Okay, now normally the normal Turing machine is supposed to be free-form conversation. So if we meet, let's say, on the elevator and we start talking, maybe first we'll talk about the class, and then I can start talking about Afghanistan, then I can start talking about something else, and until you get bored with me, I can talk about anything and you can respond in any which way you want. Okay, there is no rules and regulations that you can't talk about these topics, you can only talk about these topics. That's in some sense how we actually figure out whether, you know, the person you're talking to has the breadth to, you know, shift topics. Now, that's too hard to do, so in Loebner competition what they would do is the program has to, I mean, either the human or the program has to say, we are an expert in a particular area. And then you get to talk to them about that area. And then at the end of the conversation, you get to decide whether you just talk to a human or a machine. And if enough people thought a machine was a human, then that machine won the competition. Okay? Now, the interesting point, of course, is at least I think in 1 year, there was this human. I mean, because remember, they need to have placebos, right? They need to, if everything is a computer program, and you know that everything behind is a computer program, you would basically be saying, yeah, I think I'm talking to a computer program all the time. So you need to have, like, randomly chosen. You're randomly paired up with either a human or a machine. Okay, so they need some human experts, quote unquote. So this 1 year, there was this human expert in Shakespeare, Shakespeare Arcana, and he had a 98% confidence from outsiders that he's a machine. Okay, so they talked to him, and they talked for hours, and then figured out that anybody with a life would not know this much about Shakespeare. Do you understand what I'm saying? And so he says, he's a machine, it's a machine, it must be a program, it can't be really human. Okay, so the interesting point about that funny episode is that while Turing is a really smart guy and came up with a very nice way of figuring out whether or not the program has, quote unquote, whether or not the program looks like human, the decision is being made by other humans. And, just as Shakespeare said, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, this problem, humans also get to say some people are intelligent, some are not intelligent. So intelligence can also be in the eye of beholder. Okay? And so this definition is not an objective definition. So that's basically what the problem with the Turing test is, that it's not constructive, it's not reproducible. Different humans would say somebody is, actually a machine, or somebody is actually a program. Okay? But despite that, in fact, a Turing test was the first idea of trying to define what the goal of AI is. Okay? It actually turns out that here are four definitions, and I won't go through them slowly, but you can read them later on. And these four definitions, if you look at all the definitions of what AI is supposed to be doing, artificial intelligence is supposed to be doing, they can be sort of split into four different categories. Okay? And those are these categories. One is, one class of definitions say AI is supposed to make things that think humanly. Okay? And then there is another class which says, humans, for example, we would not make a, let's say, a bulldozer that pushes things like humans. Right? Why should we be making an intelligent machine that thinks like humans? Humans are probably kind of the losing end of the intelligence. We are more intelligent than probably dogs, but that's about it. Okay? So if we are making machines, we would probably want to say, make programs that don't imitate humans, but do better than humans. There should be a definition for the thinking that's not in terms of human, but something else. So you can say thinking rationally. So you want machines that think rationally. That's a different kind of definition. Okay? And then now you could say, what's the good point of thinking? You can just stand in the middle of rural road during rush hour and think very carefully as to what's your best option. Should you cross the road or should you stand there and get hit? Okay? And while you are thinking, you will probably get hit. Okay? So ultimately, thinking in itself is not going to actually, have any outside effect from the agent. Okay? This is like saying, at the end of the exam, you come to the teacher and say, I think extremely well. I really understand this subject. It's this silly exam that I am unable to do. Okay? But unfortunately, I can't lobotomize and tell whether or not you can think well. So I can only see your actions. Okay, so then a different way of defining is act in terms of acting. You can say acting humanly, whether or not you think humanly, can your program act humanly? And then the final definition is acting rationally. Okay, and of these definitions, thinking humanly is the one that Turing was thinking of. He thought you know, a machine basically should think humanly. And other humans who are interacting with, I'm sorry, not this, acting humanly. Turing was thinking of acting humanly because he was assuming that a program should act human so that other people act, you know, interacting with that program would be led to think that it is actually, they're interacting with humans. Okay, so that's what he was focusing on. That was his part. But you could actually say that really if you are into making intelligent agents, it turns out that actually all four are different definitions, and you could be motivated by any one of these definitions. Okay, for example, I think, you know, that generally if you take intro to AI, the definition that is sort of used in, you know, in the artificial intelligence community is acting rationally. That's all. Okay, so acting rationally meaning you did the right thing. It doesn't matter how you decided what the right thing is. I would not lobotomize you. I just want to see if you did the right thing, if you were able to optimize your return in some sense. Okay, notice that I still have to define what this doing right thing is. That's what intelligent agent design is all about. Okay, but most of traditional AI, if you take the intro to AI course, would be thinking in terms of acting rationally. That's the definition they follow. Okay, and if you are in cognitive psychology and you're trying to see if a little kid is having trouble in, you know, proper neurological development, then you need to understand how humans think, right? You need to have theories of how humans think so that you can then actually differentiate between a kid who is on the normal path to neurological development and another kid who is probably having trouble. Okay, so this definition is sort of mostly used in cognitive psychology. Acting humanly is required if your program is ever going to deal with other humans. Okay, because, you know, I mean, this is all this entire area now of computer interfaces that show empathy. Do you understand what I'm saying? So actually they have done this experimentation where the same kludgy interface, if once in a while, you know, when you make many, many mistakes in trying to get something done, if that interface sort of shows empathy and says, looks like you're having trouble, and, you know, sort of says it in some soothing voice, people apparently tend to work more, longer with that program than a program interface which says, yay, looks like you made a mistake, let's go on to something else, or just keeps quiet. Okay, so to the extent your program has to deal with other humans, it probably needs to act humanly too, just because humans want to deal with other humans mostly, unfortunately. I mean, we are like the most egocentric of species. Okay, so we want to deal with other humans, and we want to actually deal with machines or programs that seem to have human characteristics. So that's why you would have to deal with, understand, even if in fact your program is very rational, it's doing the right thing, if it has humans in the loop, it needs to start showing emotion. Okay, and it needs to, for example, also understand emotions, in particular if the human interacting with the program started screaming at the top of their voice. Okay, it should understand that they're really mad, for example. Okay, instead of just, you know, downcasing all the letters and say, so what you actually mean is this little, you know, sentence. Okay, so you do need sometimes to deal with acting humanly. So actually, in fact, another classic case, acting humanly is also computer HCI. You know, human-computer interaction is all about acting humanly. You want interaction, the interfaces that are good for humans, okay? How often do you, there are a large number of people who shut off their navigation systems because it has a really, I mean, you know, the voice on the navigation system is too naggy and it'll start yelling at you after a while. And so they don't like it. Okay, so they need like infinitely patient, soothing voice. Now, what the navigation system is telling you as to how to, what's the best route to take from here to somewhere, that it might very well be correct. It might actually have done the rational thinking and figured out the best route. But if it is, if its interaction with you is clunky, then you put it out. Okay? So you need, even if you don't care about actually being human, you need to act human just so that you can handle other humans in the loop. Another interesting thing, actually, this is kind of a interesting point that we'll talk about in a minute, but even if you are generating intelligent agents, one question is, you need to write the knowledge that a four-year-old understands about the world into this agent. Okay? Either you let the program learn it all by itself somehow, or you try to teach it. Now the question is, who has time on their hands to talk to programs and teach stuff to them? One of the most interesting things is, we seem to have tons of time on our hand to talk to kids, okay, and teach them lots and lots of stuff. In fact, kids come into this world with a large amount of domain background knowledge, but they also learn a lot during interactions with humans, okay, and we spend oodles and oodles of time talking to these kids. Okay, if we spend that kind of time with robots, robots can be, you know, given knowledge too. But who is going to do that? You know, kids look cute. Okay, now why do kids look cute? It's because, whether you believe it or not, evolution messed up with your brain. And only people who found kids to be cute went up having kids. And so only their descendants are present right now. People who hated kids never had kids, and so they are no longer here. Simple, right? So all the people who are left now think kids are cute. Now what's more interesting, we start seeing human presence and cuteness everywhere. So for example, every other day you will see CNN.com that somebody has found Mother Mary on a toast, okay, or Jesus Christ on a candy, or something else on some wall. We are always looking, you know, human presences and all sorts of things. Okay, so in fact, one of the cute things that people have learned is, if you want to train a robot and co-opt humans to training the robot, that robot better be cute. Okay, I mean, as far as robotics are concerned, you know, the robot doesn't need to look cute to people like you and me. They just need to do what they're supposed to do. But if you have to teach it stuff, it better look cute. Okay, so in fact, there was this old project, I think, called Kismet. I think it's in the MIT Media Lab or somewhere, where all they did essentially was at the top end of the robot, they put some lip kind of a thing and some eye kind of a thing. In fact, unless you've been repeatedly dropped on your head, you won't actually think that that's a kid. Okay? It looks like a cartoon, less than a cartoon caricature of a kid. But that's good enough for people to have long conversations with this robot. Okay? Because essentially you are co-opting evolution's playing with our brain to make us teach the robot. And so the robot has to act humanly just so that we will spend our valuable time to teach stuff. Okay, so that's another time when you might actually wind up following this. Now, who dealt with thinking? So I said thinking humanly is by cognitive psychologists. Thinking, acting humanly is sort of more important for HCI sort of things. Basically, ultimately the interaction between the program and humans. And I said acting rationally is what AI will focus on. But then there's one piece left, which is thinking rationally. What do you know about thinking rationally? So again, ever since the dawn of civilization, humans have tried to figure out what does it mean to think rationally. For example, logic, symbolic logic, syllogisms, propositional logic, theorem proving, all this stuff that, you know, Greeks have been doing. Was essentially try to codify what it means to think correctly. Okay, forget about the fact that you may not be thinking correctly, but what's the right way to think correctly? Okay, so for example, thinking rationally is essentially looked at in, you know, I mean, that's like the main goal of logic of any kind. You know, probabilistic logic, propositional logic, first order logic, all of them essentially think about what's the right way to think. Okay, they don't necessarily care about acting. They just want to know how to think correctly. What's the right conclusions to come to given certain information, certain evidence. Okay, so those are like, so all the definitions are important, but sort of acting rationally sort of brings together the fact that the output matters. What you do to your environment is how I decide whether you are having time, you know, whether you're being intelligent or not. And more importantly, if you're an intelligent agent, you don't probably even care about what other people think. You also want to see whether you're doing well. And what you do, how you do in your world depends upon, for example, in an abstract sense, let's say you started with some state of yourself. And then you did something, you went to some other state, some other state, some other state, and so on. Then this is basically the states of the world that you are progressing through because you're doing various actions. And whether or not you're having fun is sort of a function of this state sequence. Okay? And so presumably, you would define the performance of an intelligent agent in terms of the sequence of states it goes through. And notice that this is a very general definition. For example, suppose you're trying to think of an intelligent agent which eventually goes and, you know, gets you a cup of coffee. That's what its goal is. You know, you designed it to just get you a cup of coffee. Okay, so then it doesn't really matter what states it goes through as long as in the final state it is holding a cup of coffee and is giving it to you. Okay, now if you want it to not only get you a cup of coffee but don't do silly walks in the middle and, you know, throw coffee all over the place including on you, then you also care about what it did in the intermediate states. Every time it spilled coffee on the table or on the floor or on the carpet, that's negative. And then when it actually gave you coffee, that's positive. And imagine these are all dollars, okay? So it's like all the utilities in terms of dollars. And so you get dinged for doing this, you get some positive thing for, you know, actually giving the coffee. And then what I would say is once the robot did one sequence of states, one behavior, I can give a total score to it. And then what I'm trying to do is come up with a robot architecture which over a long period of time, the expected value of the utility of the sequence of states it goes through is maximized. And I talk about expectation. By the way, have any of you heard about the word expectation? You did probability and statistics? So for example, if I have a coin, right? And if whenever I get heads, I get $1. Whenever that, you know, head, you know, coin gets heads, I'll get $1. When it comes tails, I don't get anything, let's say. Okay? So that means every state where the coin comes heads, I get $1. Every state where coin comes tails, I get $0. Okay, and this coin, let's say, has been tossed 20 times. How much money will you get? Assume it's a fair coin. 10 is what? Remember that if you are one of those unlucky dudes, you can get 0. Right? Because it cost 20 times and you came 20 tails. And that's possible. And if you're one of these really lucky dudes, you will get $20. Because all times it came heads. So when you said 10, what did you mean? You meant expected value. Because the probability that it will come heads times the utility of heads, okay, plus probability that it will come tails times the utility of tails. And since it only can come either heads or tails, there is some probability such that it's P1 times this plus 1 minus P1 times this. Okay? And remember that this was, you know, $10, and this was $1, and this was $0, and for a fair coin, this is 0.5, this is 0.5. Which is why you got each toss of the coin, you expect 50 cents. And if you do 20 tosses, you expect $10. Okay? Now, you know, basically, when you are designing intelligent agents, you need to consider expectations. Why? Because if even, you know, so for example, I mean, this is classic thing, right? People will say that, I mean, there was this, you could be doing quote unquote the right thing, and your friend is doing the wrong thing, and you got killed and your friend did not. That's possible. Why is that possible? Because actions can have uncertain effects. Okay, so you always look behind like this when you are driving. Your friend always drank and drove. And you got hit by some trucker who came, you know, basically and, you know, mowed into your car. Your friend did not. So what are other people supposed to learn from this? That people who carefully look and do defensive driving get killed, whereas people who drink and drive do well? That's the wrong lesson to pick. Okay? What you really need to consider is, among all the people who are doing defensive driving, and among all the people who are doing drunken driving, what's the expected utility for the people who do defensive driving, and what is the expected utility for people who do drunken driving, and then decide from that which is the better design. Okay? So that's why you need to consider, you know, you basically consider expectations. Okay. So these are all basically what I said, cognitive science, loss of thought, Turing test. And then one other thing just before I go forward actually to talk about intelligent agent design and to actually put this in perspective of current day things is, while we are talking about how to design intelligent agents, it's also true that you already know that there are many programs that do things that previously we thought only humans can do. Okay, and you need, how many of you have, you all took SAT, right? So you should know this word. Shibboleth. Take SAT again, okay. Shibboleth actually is a very interesting word. It was at one point of time, I believe in Middle Ages, they had to tell the difference between Jewish and non-Jewish people at some place, okay? So there's an entry point and you're trying to decide whether this person is Jewish or not Jewish, and they would ask them to say this Hebrew word, Shibboleth. And non-Jewish people would not be able to say it right. And Jewish people would be able to say it right. So this Shibboleth was used to figure out who is really Jewish, who is not really Jewish. It's a test for figuring out Jewish versus non-Jewish. Okay? And what's interesting is, in the context of web, where, remember, they said that, you know, on the internet, nobody needs to know that you're a dog. So that was like a famous cartoon, right? Because you don't know who is behind a particular website. Okay? And you don't know who is clicking, whether it is a human or it's a program. And many a time, you want, for example, humans to click because you put advertisements that are supposed to be seen by humans. Only humans will probably read the advertisements and maybe once in a while buy stuff. So on the web, actually, you are trying to play the Turing test. If you have like a bank account, a bank portal, or some mail account generation portal, okay? You want to see whether the person who is trying to make a mail account is a human or a machine. And you don't want to allow machines to make accounts. So you need to tell, you need a shibboleth, essentially, to differentiate machines from humans. Okay? And where do those shibboleths come from? It comes from AI. Whatever AI still can't do, basically means humans can do it, machines still can't do it. So those become the right tests to differentiate between humans and machines, right? So obviously many of you have, you know, gone through, I think this actually first started when Yahoo started giving free email accounts less than 5-10 years back. And then people started making, people found that there's a cheap way of getting free storage. Generate, about 1.5 million mail accounts. and each of them only 10 megabytes, so 1.5 million times 10 megabytes of free storage for you. So of course, since even people have reasonable work to do, so they can't keep doing these 1.5 million mail accounts by themselves, so they would write. In fact, on the internet, the word robot means something completely different. When you say robot normally to a kid, it's like this cute thing which walks, right? On the internet, when they say robot, it's a program which does something repeatedly. And so they would write these robot programs which will just generate huge number of, keep submitting multiple number of mail forms and get about 1.5 million Yahoo accounts. And Yahoo would be thinking, my God, we have so many people. They all seem to have crazy names though, like XY975 time, etc. But we have so many mail customers. And then one day they figured out, obviously, that it's not making any sense. It was basically run by their program. So now you need to have a way of telling whether it's a program or a human. And so you're stuck with these, right? When you go to a web page, you are asked to tell what is this, write this here. The assumption is that it is easy enough for humans and hard still for computer programs. But this is an arms race. As AI improves, captchas have to be harder and harder. In fact, right now, these things can actually be done quite easily. Okay? So then they will put a lot more noise behind the letters. And then at some point of time, they will start giving you captchas such as, does the following picture have a fish? And then a program probably won't know whether there's a fish or not. Or it might say, tell me some of the animals in the following picture. And you easily can tell a program still doesn't know. Why? Because computer vision is still hard. They can give you a little math problem, which probably will make most of the high school dropouts to fail, but maybe you don't want to give them, a mail account. And hopefully, all the programs will also fail on those math problems. And the people who can solve that math problem will get in. Now, the interesting thing is, I want you to understand, is that what AI can do is just as important as what AI can't do. Because CAPTCHA guys hope that AI can't do too much, right? Because the more AI can do, the harder it becomes to differentiate between humans and machines. Okay? Now, this is a cute story, actually, that when originally CAPTCHAs were invented, they found that people who wanted extra email accounts were not going to be deterred by this. So what would they do? You start opening an email account at Yahoo. You clip the CAPTCHA test, show it to a human, let's say, in some other country who probably can work for much cheaper prices, and say, what is it? And they will type what it is. So your program, you being not you, the human, but a program, basically will go to Yahoo, get the CAPTCHA, show it to somebody in Brazil, India, or China who is just waiting there doing nothing. And when they see this, they'll say, oh, it is ET76. They'll type it. And then it will take that and put into Yahoo's web page. That's it. So this is AAI, right? It's artificial intelligence. And as long as you have humans who don't have good enough jobs, you would have free, cheap human labor. And you can use that to defeat this. In fact, it apparently was done for a while. It was done for a while, where people were making something like 1 cent for every 3 captchas that they would decode. Okay? Again, it's because it's an arms race. When captchas were trying to keep people away, the programs away, and then the people who wrote the programs can be smarter. Okay? So that's kind of an interesting thing. And in fact, you can read about, how many of you know about ESP game? One interesting point, actually, although this class and next class is really, and AI in general, is really about how to generate artificial intelligent agents. You know the easiest way to generate intelligent agents? Forget about artificial, just easiest way to generate intelligent agents. Wernher von Braun, not me, but Wernher von Braun once said that the cheapest way to mass produce intelligent agents is to have babies. And I guess, a lot of people already figured this out in junior high. Okay? And so you know how to make intelligent agents because, they're cheap. Essentially, in terms of you don't need to know how to make, how to figure out how to do the program. Okay? But even if you don't like that cynicism, in general, the percentage of brain cycles of humans in the world that are actually being used to do something reasonable is vanishingly small. So we have huge amount of pre-brain cycles. And one of the issues that people are interested in, which is not really AI, but it's, AAI, is how to get humans to do work free for them. And this picture is Tom Sawyer, and many of you have read Tom Sawyer's story, right? Tom Sawyer's story. And the interesting thing is this guy was supposed to, at one point of time he has to paint the wall, because I think his aunt basically asked him, go paint the wall, okay? And he really didn't want to do it. So what does he do? He, starts, painting it and acts as if he's really having a huge amount of fun. And so all the kids want to do it free. So he then sits down and, actually charges them to paint the wall and they'll do it free for him. Okay? So one way of taking this kind of suckers, which by the way all of you are, including myself, is to make it look like fun. People will do crazy things for fun, free. Okay? And so an interesting thing in the ESP game, which is basically a set of, this is a kind of a program where people will play games and as part of the game they're doing free stuff for somebody. Go read up about ESP. How many of you know about ESP game? If not, go read about it. We can talk about it next class anyway. But I want to start talking about, so as I said, acting rationally is what we are going to be interested in. And what we need to do essentially is generate an architecture for a machine which takes some performance metric over the sequence of states it goes through, and then it optimizes that performance metric, expected value of that performance metric. Okay. So here is one intelligent agent. In fact, we'll use that as sort of an example in the background as we go this class, next class. You must have seen this at least, unless you're just so damn busy doing homework for these classes that you have no clue what's going on in the world. This is the Google car. And apparently unsuspecting population in Bay Area are driving their cars along with these cars. And these cars essentially drive themselves. There's like a kid, there's like a researcher sitting here who does have full control over the car, but essentially the car is driving itself. And the human is there only to just put a brake in case something goes wrong. This is like learner permit. When you guys were doing learner permit, you're not much better than this car. In fact, this car is much better than you. Okay. So the question is, how do we go about designing intelligent agents and what makes the design hard? Under what conditions is intelligent agent design easier? Under what conditions is it harder? That's what we'll try to understand. So this is my robot. Right? Very cute looking. It has eyes and a very nice square mouth. And it basically is working in some environment. So this robot, the car is working in the San Francisco roads. That's its environment. Okay? A Yahoo robot, a robot which is trying to make email accounts on the Yahoo, it's a program that's working on the cyber world. Now, in any agent, if it is going to be, if we're going to talk about acting intelligently, the minimum that agent needs, the minimum the agent needs is the ability to influence the environment. If you cannot act, then how can you change the environment? You will just be an observer. Right? Okay? So there are some effectors that this agent uses to change the environment. That's required. The second thing that the agent has, and so given that it has effectors or the actions that it can do, the $1 million or multi-million dollar or $1 billion question in AI is what's the next action to do? That's it. You're trying to, write a program for, controlling this guy, which just tells it what is the next action to do. And that action will change the environment, take it to a different state. Then it will do a next action and a next action, and then that will give rise to a sequence of states. And then you are taking the expected value of these sequences of states and trying to see whether this is a good design or not. Okay, so first thing is you need effectors. What else do you need? You need sensors. You need to be able to look at the world. Not look, I mean you need to have a way of sensing the world. You can look, hear, feel, anything. Okay? Given that you have effectors and sensors, you're just trying to figure out what action to do next. Okay? So, let's think of, so basically, every agent sort of needs what can it perceive, what actions can it do, and what is it trying to achieve, you know, what goals are it trying to achieve, and what is, and then overall, how is its environment, and then that kind of the characteristics of the environment, we'll talk about it in a minute. So if you have Google car, the percepts are video, accelerometers, gauges, engine sensors, keyboard, GPS, blah, blah, blah. Those are the percepts. That's how it sees the world. Okay? Actions are steering, accelerating, braking, honking, and showing various finger gestures. Those are all actions. Okay? Don't discount the finger gestures, because that's just as good a part of getting into an accident as anything else. Right? And so those are the actions. Goals, okay, get there, get wherever, get back to the Google headquarters, okay. Safety, don't get sued, you know, although it's a multi-billion dollar company, you know, if enough people sue it, it'll go bankrupt. Maximize profits, if you're a taxi driver, you might want to maximize profits, obey laws, passenger comfort, etc. These are the goals. Now notice that some of these goals would be true, that can be evaluated just in the final state. For example, have I reached Google headquarters? That's just evaluated in the final state. Other things like obeying laws are evaluated in every state. If you disobeyed the law for about half an hour in the middle, then basically you lost points on that. Okay? And then finally, environment. In the case of Google's car, the environment are US urban streets, freeways, traffic, pedestrians, and weather, and customers, and, you know, if you're a taxi driver, also customers. That's your environment. Now, let's look at one last thing, and then you can go. Internet shopping agent, or let's say something like a Yahoo mail stealing agent. Okay, it too is an agent. Its percepts are partial contents of the, you know, like if you're trying to buy something on the web from, let's say, Macy's or something, you need to send get and then figure out what possible things are available to buy. Okay? Actions would be things like get, post, do a credit card transaction. Those would be your actions. Goals probably would be cheapest price on some particular items that you're trying to buy. And the environment here is internet. Not US urban streets, it's internet, so it might have congestion, it might have traffic, there may be multiple places you can buy stuff from, and you have to figure out which ones to actually go to. Okay, when we come back next class, we'll spend a lot of time with this picture, and you might want to look at this, and this picture is all about the environment, and how environments can be easier versus harder, and in particular, we'll talk about deterministic versus stochastic, fully versus partially observable environments, and static versus dynamic environments. Deterministic versus stochastic means I know if I put this thing like this, I know exactly that will stand that way. That's deterministic action. If I have a shaky hand and I try to put it, it may fall, it may stand. That's a stochastic action. Okay? Fully versus partially observable. Right now, I can look at you, except the contents of this laptop this guy is looking at. So I know most of what's going on in my environment. If I close my eyes, I can still hear, but I don't know what you guys are doing. So that's partial observability. And the final thing is static versus dynamic. In a static world, if I stop talking, the world stops. Because I'm the only thing that's doing anything in the world. Clearly, this is not a static world because if I stop talking, you start walking, right? And it's a dynamic world where there are other agents. And it turns out that it's easier to obviously deal with deterministic, observable, static worlds. And it'll be harder to deal with stochastic, partially observable, dynamic worlds. Okay? We'll talk about this and then talk about what boxes will be there in an intelligent agent software architecture. Okay?